Now, when the way most people or most teachers approach eschatology in teaching it, at least in my experience, has been that basically to teach it in a very topical way, in the sense of we might say almost proof texting, where you kind of go from topic to topic within eschatology and you show why we believe, or you show what we believe, and then you go to texts that prove that. So you talk about the millennium, and this is what the millennium is, and you go to all the passages that talk about the millennium, and then you talk about the rapture. What's the rapture? Well, here are all the arguments about the rapture, and here are the passages to go to the rapture. That's oftentimes how eschatology is taught. And I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. That's a normal way to teach it. The reason that I have opted for something different is because I think many of you here, if not most of you, many of you know to some degree what we believe as a church about eschatology. But I think there's more of a question of why, and is it really biblical? And so what I've tried to do is develop it not so much from the standpoint of going from topic to topic and cross-referencing everything, but rather starting like we did in the Old Testament at the beginning, and look how scripturally it develops. And we looked at the covenants. We looked at the Abrahamic covenant. We looked at the Old Covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the New Covenant. We looked at how they build on each other, how they were revealed over time, and how they were all related. And how in the Old Testament it's prophesied that the Abrahamic, the Davidic, and the New Covenant are all going to come together at the time of the day of the Lord. And we looked at the day of the Lord in the Old Testament, what happens and all that. And the reason I've done it this way is because I want you to see the context of these passages, because that's what lends to conviction. If you do it the other way, people tend to get confused, because you're going to passages that they have no idea what the context is. They're totally dependent on you for explaining the context. And oftentimes the context is totally ignored. And to thinking people, oftentimes those passages seem, it's like, well, how's that relate to what you just said? And so what I'm trying to do is develop the context of the Old Testament in relation to the covenants and how they work. And what we've done, I've just described, then we talked a little bit about the kingdom, which comes after the day of the Lord, or at the day of the Lord. And now we're looking at Daniel. And we started to look at Daniel, and what Daniel tells us is two things, really. One is it gives us the time, the thing that no other prophet in the Old Testament does. And we'll look at that more when we get to Daniel 9. It talks about, it gives very specific time frames. But what we're going to look at tonight, and what a lot appears in Daniel, is the political situation at the return of Christ. The political situation when Christ returns. Now, this is where we get a little bit more complicated, because the temptation here is to look at a lot of different references in the New Testament. We will look at some, actually. Because this is where Daniel and Revelation come together. This is why Daniel and Revelation, when it comes to eschatology, are almost always taught side by side, and we're going to see why that is tonight, hopefully, if we have time to do everything that I plan to do. I gave you notes, although I'm not going to follow them too closely. I may refer to them. What I really want to do mainly is read and explain. Read and explain. And the reason I'm doing this, some of you are very familiar with the book of Daniel. Some of you are probably more familiar with the book of Daniel than I am. Some of you could probably teach this, but some of you, I'm sure, aren't that familiar with the book of Daniel. Nothing. I mean, it's just everybody's at a different knowledge level. And if I start talking about this kingdom and that kingdom and going to this verse and that verse, it gets confusing to those who don't have a real good sense of Daniel. So what I want to do is read and make connections as we go. I'm not going to read, obviously, the whole book or all these chapters. But let us go to Daniel chapter 2. Now, we looked at Daniel chapter 2 last time. I'm not going to read through all this and go through this again, but this was the image. This was the image that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he had this dream of the image. You remember the story, and it had a head of gold, and a chest of silver, belly and thighs of brass, and legs and feet of iron. And the feet and toes were iron, clay mixed. And then that stone cut without hands came out of the came out of nowhere or from heaven and knocked the statue over, destroyed it. And that stone then became the kingdom and filled the whole earth, became a mountain. Now that's Daniel chapter 2. And we looked at the fact that these are clearly, it says this, each part of that image represented a kingdom. And we want to look especially, and again, we looked at this a little bit last time, but I just want to read it, and then we go on to chapter 7. The fourth kingdom is the interesting kingdom. It's the one that we're going to look at tonight. It's the legs of iron and the feet of and toes of mixed iron and clay. Now, no one denies that the fourth kingdom, no matter what your eschatological position, no one denies that the fourth kingdom is Rome. Okay? But let me read verse 40. We'll start there. I just want to read this and make a few comments as we go. It says, then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another. They will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Now, then it says in verse 44, in the days of those kings, and what it says, those kings, it's referring to the ten toes. Those ten toes refer to ten kings. We come across them later, and we come across them in the book of Revelation. Those ten kings, it says, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put to an end all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Now, and then it says, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the irons, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. Now, I just want to stop and reiterate, we talked about this a little bit last time. Do you understand that an all-millennialist position, okay, has to have this stone hitting the image at the first coming of Christ? Because it's then that the kingdom is set up. Do you understand that? Does that make sense to you? Okay, as a premillennialist, I think I can show this tonight. I'll show this later as we go through. As a premillennialist, I believe this is referring to the second coming of Christ. Revelation 19. When he comes in Revelation 19 is when the stone hits the kingdoms. And when he sets up his kingdom, Revelation 20. Okay? Now just understand that's where we're coming from as premillennialists. Okay? So that this kingdom, in other words, this ten toes represents the political situation around the time of Christ's second coming. In other words, we can put it this way. When Christ returns, there is going to be a political situation that is in some way, sense, shape, an extension of the Roman Empire, the fourth kingdom. And that it's going to be divided. It says very plainly that the reason there are ten toes is because the kingdom was divided. It says that. And then it says that in verse 42, as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will be combined with one another in the seed of men. Some have referred suggested this refers to democracy, that these kings will actually have mixed with ordinary people, and the idea is that there was some form of democracy. I'm not going to die on that hill, but that's, I think, certainly a possibility. At any rate, I would argue, and I think you can show, that this is the political situation at Christ's return. Now, if you go to chapter 7, Daniel chapter 7 is a vision that Daniel had. Daniel chapter 2 was a vision Nebuchadnezzar had and Daniel interpreted. Daniel 2 is at right at the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, like the second year of it. Okay? Daniel 7 is the first year of Belshazzar, so many years later. This is many years later, long after the vision of chapter 2, but Daniel has a vision in chapter 7. Now, as we read this, and this is the chart here, I just want to point out that these kingdoms in chapter... No, I don't think anybody denies this. Everybody agrees with this. Daniel chapter 7, the kingdoms that are listed here are parallel to the ones in chapter 2. I think I pointed this out last time. So start in chapter 7, and let's read part of this at least. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. Now, again, for sake of time, I'm just going to tell you, that's Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, Arise, devour much meat. That's Media Persia. That's the kingdom that came after Babylon. Verse 6. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. That's Greece. Verse 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. This fourth beast is parallel to the fourth beast in chapter 2. Dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. The description's similar. Remember, it used iron in chapter 2. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with his feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Now, just again, the 10 horns, clearly we find out later, are 10 kings. The 10 horns, the 10 kings, are parallel to the 10 toes in chapter 2. It's the same 10 kings. Okay. Verse 8, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn. Now, this is new. Okay, this is new. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Now, let me just stop here. This is new. This is not part of chapter 2. This is a new thing. Now, we know what the horn is. The horn is a ruler. That becomes very clear as you read the rest of the book. Okay? There's no doubt about this. The ruler is, what we come to find, this is speaking of the Antichrist. This one ruler, this one horn will come out from among the 10 horns. Okay? He will come out of the 10 kings. He is going to be a ruler. It says, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. So apparently he's going to replace 3 of the kings. Okay? 3 of the rulers. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Now that may sound rather oblique at this point, but again, as we go through the book, we will find this is a very common theme in relation to the Antichrist. And I think what it's pointing to, and we'll see this in a minute, but I'm just kind of helping you along, what it's pointing to is this horn is going to proclaim himself to be equal with God. That's a common theme throughout the book of Daniel in relation to this horn. It's also seen in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It's also seen in Revelation chapter 13. They all coincide. Okay? This little horn is one that speaks great swelling words. That is, he makes himself equal to God. Verse 9, I kept looking until the thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. This is obviously the throne room of God. The court sat, the books were opened. Then I looked, because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Now let me just point out, that is Revelation 19. There's not much secret about this. If you look at Revelation 19, and Christ returns, he says he slays the beast and puts him in burning fire. Okay, that happens at the return of Christ. What I want you to see is this is parallel to the stone hitting the image in chapter 2. The Son of Man taking the kingdom here in Revelation or Daniel 7 is parallel to the stone hitting the image in chapter 2 when the kingdom is set up. Does that make sense? So verse 12, as for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I think the point of that is simply saying that the final Antichrist is an extension of all these other kingdoms. There's a continuity in these kingdoms, which you see throughout Daniel. Verse 13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days, was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, men of every language might serve him. His dominion is everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Again, words very reminiscent of the book of Revelation. Now, it's interesting that as we read the rest of chapter 7, Daniel doesn't even address the first three kingdoms. We know that more by putting A and B together as you go through the book. But he does ask about the fourth kingdom. In fact, there's more written in here in these two visions about the fourth kingdom than about Christ's kingdom. A lot of verses are given to the fourth kingdom. Verse 15, as for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth. Now, I should kind of point out, too, in Daniel, kings and kingdoms kind of almost become interchangeable. Kings represent kingdoms they rule, and kingdoms often refer to... I mean, it's not always as simple as... we often think of them as separate, but they tend to overlap in Daniel for whatever reason. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Verse 19, then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceeding dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder of its feet, and the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell. Namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth, uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints. This is another theme, the Antichrist waging war against the saints, which again you see in the book of Revelation. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints, of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. That's referring to Revelation 19. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth. This was the answer. Which will be different from all the other kingdoms, will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise. So these are 10 kings that will somehow come out of some form of, some extension of the Roman Empire, which is the fourth kingdom. Another will rise after them. That's the little horn. And he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He will speak, here we again have the theme of his arrogance, he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alteration in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, a times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years. That time period is given several times in the book of Daniel. It is given several times in the book of Revelation in 3 different ways, in months, days, and years. Everybody wants to make these numbers, they want to do tricks with these numbers. They say they're symbolic. It's hard to do tricks. It's defined 3 different ways, in days, months, and years. It's 3.5 years. This king will reign for 3.5 years. And we come across this again in the book of Revelation. It says, but the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom. So notice, that kingdom that he's talking about comes in when these kingdoms are destroyed. That is when the Antichrist is destroyed. When the beast is thrown in the fire, which happens, I don't know how people, honestly, I don't know how they deal with it, because Revelation 19 says, when he comes, he throws the beast in the fire. The beast is the Antichrist. The beast is this little horn. It's not hard to figure out. I'll show you this in the book of Revelation. Okay? There's no way you can have the kingdom before that. It's impossible. Exegetically, it's impossible. It's not foggy. Okay? If you look at chapter 8, and I won't read all this, but I want to explain to you what Daniel is doing. We won't read the beginning of chapter 8, but Daniel has another vision, and it's of a ram and a goat. Now, in this case, he defines both of them very clearly. The ram is Media-Persia, and the goat is Alexander the Great. Okay? He defines it. And it speaks about the fact that, why don't we read some of it? Look at chapter 5. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. This is Alexander the Great. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram that had 2 horns, this is Media-Persia, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come, and by the way, this is exactly what happened in history. If you read about it, Alexander the Great and how he destroyed Persia, it's pretty amazing. It was with incredible speed, with incredible power, and it was not expected. I mean, Persia had a huge army. And they had a much larger army than Alexander the Great. But Alexander the Great was an incredible military genius. And it says in verse 70, I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered with his 2 horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him. There was none to rescue the ram with his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up 4 conspicuous horns toward the 4 winds of heaven. That's exactly what happened. Alexander the Great died at a very young age. Was he 33 or whatever? And his 4 generals, his kingdom was split in 4 ways. By the way, this is one of the reasons, as I mentioned before, that all the liberals want to move Daniel much farther up, because there's no way, you know, if you don't believe in predictive prophecy, there's no way Daniel at the time of Belshazzar could have known this. So they always try to move it beyond Greece. But at any rate, we're not left to wonder who these are. And I just want to jump ahead and point this out so you know that this isn't just something I think. If you look at verse 15, look down at verse 20. He says, this is the interpretation. He says, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the king of Media and Persia. Okay, so we know that. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. That's Alexander the Great. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. Well, that describes exactly what happened. Now, the point here, and I think the reason, at least partially, that Daniel talks about Greece and Medo-Persia is to say something more about the horn. You notice again here, the horn represents a king, and Alexander the Great is the horn. But he talks then in verse 9, this is going back to the vision. He says, out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. Now let me just say what's going on here before I go through this. This is not the little horn of Daniel 7. Okay? I want to emphasize that. We know that. The little horn came out of the fourth kingdom. This horn came out of one of the kingdoms that came out of Alexander the Great's kingdom. Okay? It is not the same. And we know that clearly. The little horn that's spoken of here in verse 9 and following, we know who he is. He's Antiochus Epiphanes. Not a great ruler from the standpoint of history, but he was famous because of what he did to Israel, because of how he persecuted Israel, and because of what he did to the temple. Now, the reason I point this out is because I think Daniel, what Daniel's doing is showing us, and there's good reason to believe this. I'll show you in a minute. The reason Daniel's doing this is this becomes clearly a type of the little horn in chapter 7. Now, I don't think it's, again, this gets a little complicated, and this is what's hard about Daniel, because you're trying to show everything at once, but let me just read and continue reading, but I want to point this out. What he's doing here is he's giving us more information. He's not just telling us about Antiochus Epiphanes. He is giving us a type of the Antichrist. Now, let's just read and we'll look at it. Verse 9. Out of one of them came forth a small horn. That's one of the kingdoms that came out of Alexander's kingdom, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. The beautiful land is Israel. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth and to trample them down. I think most would agree that, or most would say that he's talking about persecution of the saints here, that he actually persecuted God's people. Verse 11, it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. That's God. Here you have again the concept that the Antichrist makes himself equal with God. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down, and on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Now, well, let me just keep reading here. And I'll come back. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled. He said to me, for 2300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. Several reasons we would say this is clearly a type of the horn or the type of the Antichrist that's coming. One is because of how it's described. It's always the same. He is arrogant, exceeding great. He magnifies himself to be equal with God. He persecutes God's people. But maybe the clincher is this is the first mention of what is called the abomination of desolations. That's a term that Jesus used in Matthew 24. It's used several times in the book of Daniel. It doesn't always refer to the same event. That's what's confusing. The abomination of desolations, the first reference to it is here, and it's referring to the time that Antiochus Epiphanes, a ruler, came to Jerusalem and desecrated the temple. and actually offered pigs on the altar. And this is called the abomination of desolation. This is the desecration of the temple. And let's see how to make this clear. The reason we know that this isn't the only time it's referred to is because we know this happened again with Titus. And we know that this was predicted by Jesus in Matthew 24. He said, when you see the abomination of desolations, you remember that in Matthew 24? Well, this event had already taken place by then. This event took place in 167 AD or BC. So that's almost 200 years before. And Jesus says, beware, you know, when you see the abomination of desolation. Well, that happened 200 years ago when Jesus said that. But now, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but if you turn over to chapter 9, we're going to look at this in detail probably next week, the 70 weeks. In the middle of the 70th week, this abomination of desolation is referred to again. Look at chapter 9, verse... it's hard to do this without doing a lot of explaining, but look at verse 27. And he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. Now, I believe, and I'll explain this next week, but I believe that that person that he says he is the little horn. This ruler that's described in chapter 2 and chapter 7 and in type in Antiochus Epiphanes. He says, he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. That's the tribulation. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now that's confusing, I'm sure, to you just now. I will try to make that clear next week. But what I'm trying to point out is this abomination of desolation in chapter 9 is not the same one in chapter 8. But they're referring to the same kind of event, if that makes sense. This is an example of what I've talked about before in the Old Testament. There's often, for lack of a better word, we've all struggled with what to call it and how to describe it, but for lack of a better word, pre-fulfillment or multiple fulfillments or a pre-fulfillment and an ultimate fulfillment. You have that a great deal in the Old Testament, and we're dealing with prophecy. And, we've talked about that before. But that abomination of desolations is part of the whole thing in relation to the little horn. Okay, now you go to chapter 9. I'm going to skip over chapter 9 for now. We're going to come back to that next week. Now, if you go to chapter 11, okay, and again, I'm not going to go through this either because this is a lot of time, but I just want to point a couple things out. If you go to chapter 11, chapter 11 is this chapter that everyone reads, and it reads like a history book, but the problem is the average person like you and me has no idea what it's referring to. It's not as simple as the other ones, but it is explaining in detail the various conflicts that happened after the fall of Alexander the Great. And it goes through in great detail the kings and the various issues. You know, kings are killed, kings die, kings take over, and all this back and forth. And then it comes to a particular king that, again, all agree is describing the same one, Antiochus Epiphanes. And that starts in verse 21 and goes through verse 35. That's describing Antiochus Epiphanes. I'm not going to read all that. It's the same king. Well, I will maybe read part of it because, again, you'll see the same kinds of things that we talked about before in relation to the Antichrist. Verse 21, in his place a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Let's see. You know what? I'm not going to read all this. This is too much detail, and I don't have time. But this is describing, most would agree, okay, looking at the commentaries, most would agree that this is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, okay, based on the facts of his life. But when you come to verse 36, many would, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about this because, again, I haven't looked at all the commentaries, but many would suggest that verses 36 through 39 is a change, that it's no longer talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, but now it's talking about the little horn of chapter 7. In other words, the one whom Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of. Okay? So starting in verse 36, and this is very parallel to 2 Thessalonians 2. The same kind of wording in relation to the Antichrist is seen in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god. There you have it. And will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. Now let me just point out, one of the reasons that commentators would say this isn't talking about Antiochus Epiphanes is because the whole description doesn't really fit Antiochus Epiphanes. Just want to point that out. But here we have again, he's speaking great things. So this again points us back to the little horn of chapter 7. You remember he had eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things? This kind of points us in that direction. It says he's above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over the many and will parcel out land for a price. So that is speaking, I believe, of the same thing. Now, if you look also, well, let me just, this is actually speaking of an Antiochus Epiphanes, but if you look back at verse 31, it speaks of this abomination of desolation again. Speaking of Antiochus Epiphanes, forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. That abomination of desolation is the same as the one in chapter 8. Am I confusing you yet? Okay, now, let me, in the time remaining, let me just maybe stop. We're going to go to the New Testament now with this as a background. But does anybody have any questions based on what I've said so far? Rome. And I think the implication, you know, some have argued that the two legs implied the division of East and West. I mean, I don't know if we could say that, but generally all would agree that it's referring to Rome, the iron. Well, I would say it this way. I would say, and I actually respond to this in a minute, but the reason that I don't think it makes sense is because you have the book of Revelation. Okay? The book of Revelation is written, now, I think in 90-something A.D. Some of the preterists would put it at 60-something A.D. Either way, it's 30, 40 years after Christ. If you look at Revelation chapter 17... which we're going to look at if we have time. If you look at Revelation chapter 17, the 10 kings spoken of here in Daniel still haven't received their power. It says they haven't received their power yet. Okay, so it's still future as of the writing of the book of Revelation. Now, if Christ's first coming, which is 40 years before the writing of the book of Revelation, was the demolishing of the kingdom, why haven't they even received their kingdoms yet? And then the beast, which is clearly a reference to this same thing, in the book of Revelation, is not slain until Revelation 19 when Christ comes. But we'll look at that in a minute. But that's a good question. The point, I think, is that it's an extension of Rome. In other words, we might even say it's Western civilization, which is an extension of the Roman Empire, which would, I think, very well answer the whole idea of clay and iron mixed. But I think it's interesting to note that if you look at world power, it's always resided in what has come out of the Roman Empire, Europe. And you could even maybe argue, to some degree, America is an extension of that empire. Not geographically, but maybe at least in terms of ideas. And the idea is that empire would break down the whole world and rule, I think, the whole world, which is, I think, what you have at the time of the Antichrist. I don't know if that helps you. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Comments? Thoughts? Okay, turn over to the book of Revelation. And we can see the connections of some of these things. And I'm not going to go through all this for sake of time. And I'm not going to try to explain all this for sake of time, because we will look at the book of Revelation in the future. But if you look at chapter 12, verse 3, in this vision, "Then another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. Now, we have a beast here with 10 horns, which would imply Daniel. This dragon is, we know from, I think, verse 8, is Satan in this passage. I don't want to read this whole passage for sake of time. But it is described as Satan. Yeah, verse 13. No, it's not verse 13. Verse 9, "And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil." Okay, that dragon, this dragon is Satan. Now, this gets a little confusing in the book of Revelation, but I want to emphasize that Satan is seen in the book of Revelation as the one who energizes these kings. And we could even say these kingdoms. He is the one behind the world rulers. I think you see this throughout the Bible. I think you see it in places like Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel and other places. But you have this concept that Satan is the one who is behind and the one energizing these kings. But now if you look at verse 13 or chapter 13, we have another beast, and the beast is not Satan. In this case, it's the kingdom. But in verse 13, it says, or chapter 13, it says, "And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion." Now let me just say, those three creatures are the three creatures in the vision in chapter 7. The point is that this creature is a continuation of all those kingdoms. This is a continuation of the kingdoms of the world. And I should also point out that it has the 10 horns, and it says, "On his horns were 10 diadems, and on his head were blasphemous names." So this is a blasphemous kingdom. "And the dragon gave him his power." Now that dragon is the dragon mentioned in chapter 12, who is Satan. See, the dragon that's mentioned in chapter 12 is seen here in this vision as separate from the beast. The dragon is Satan, the beast is the nations. I don't think it happened yet. Yeah, I don't think that happened yet. But I don't want to deal with that now for sake of time. But I think what chapter 12 is referring to, I think, is in the middle of the tribulation. And again, it mentions the 3.5 years again in chapter 12, and it talks about persecuting the woman who who I think is Israel. But that's, I don't want to get into that right now because it's aside to my purpose, which is to talk about the beast. But we'll talk about that. Good question. Verse 3 of chapter 13, I saw one of his heads as it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon. Remember, the dragon is Satan. So we're talking about they worshipped Satan. Because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him? There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. That's the little horn. That's the little horn of Daniel chapter 7 that was given a mouth and had eyes like a man and spoke blasphemies. This is what Antiochus Epiphanes was a type of when he spoke arrogantly and made himself equal to God. It says, were given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and authority to act for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. A time, a times, and a half a time was given to him. So that's the same person. That's the same one that's spoken of in the book of Daniel. Okay, same time frame, given in different numbers. Verse 6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God. Clearly, the little horn of Daniel. To blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is those who dwell in heaven. Verse 7, it was also given to him to make war with the saints. Again, this comes from Daniel. And to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. That's world government. All who dwell on the earth will worship him. That's satanic worship. Everyone whose name was not written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast. Now again, at this point, I'm saying the beast is the Antichrist, okay? Because of how he's described in these words, he's the little horn, okay? This is why beast gets confusing in Revelation. The beast is the Antichrist. Okay, but now this second one in chapter 11, or verse 11, he exercises all the authority of the first beast, that is this Antichrist, in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, the Antichrist, whose fatal wound was healed. That answers what the fatal wound was earlier in the chapter, when his head... So apparently this Antichrist is miraculously healed, and this other person, who is later in the book referred to as the false prophet, points people to worship the Antichrist. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men, and he deceives those who dwell on earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast. Now we're talking about the image of the beast. And now, again, I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, but generally speaking, I would say this is, and I think most dispensationalists would agree, this is the abomination of desolations. This is what happens in the middle of the tribulation. This is what referred to in Daniel chapter 9 when it talks about the middle of the week, there's an abomination of desolations. In other words,
in the middle of the week, is that speaking of
the tribulation? Yes. All saints, because there will be saints besides Jews, but including Israel. And then it says, and it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free man and slave to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. Now, again, I'm not going to go into all the detail of that passage, but all that to say, that beast is referring to the little horn of Daniel chapter 7, the little horn who speaks great words. And if you go, we could look at, we don't have time, but we could look at Revelation 17 and 18, the beast, we find the beast again, and this time the harlot riding the beast. Okay? And then we have the fall of the harlot in chapter 18, Babylon. Then we come to chapter 19, and we have Christ coming. And this is what it says. Again, keep this in mind in light of what we just read. Verse 15, from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. This is obviously Psalm 2. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God, the Almighty, day of the Lord, terminology. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, the flesh of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both men, free men and slaves, and small and great. And I saw the beast. That's the king. That's the little horn. That's the Antichrist. And the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. This is at the second coming of Christ. The little horn, Antichrist, the beast, is slain when Christ returns. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet. The false prophet is the one mentioned in chapter 13 that caused everyone to worship him, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. So you understand that the book of Revelation is an expansion of Daniel. Of all that Daniel gave us the kind of outline of the political situation when Christ would return. And that political, that's another good argument, by the way, for the shortness of the period between Revelation 6 and 19. This is one ruler. The beast comes to power in the middle of the tribulation, and he's slain when Christ returns. This maybe speaks to Mark's question. I have on page 87, with this I close, the futurity of the fourth kingdom and the little horn. In other words, the fact that this is all future, that it didn't happen in AD 70, it didn't happen when Christ came the first time, it didn't happen yet. And the reason we know that is because, and I list these reasons, if Christ demolished the kingdoms of the world and set up his kingdom at his first coming, why is the demise of these kingdoms still future in the book of Revelation, which is written long after Christ's first coming? Why haven't the 10 kings even received their kingdom as of the writing of the book of Revelation, Revelation 17, 12? And why is it that Christ slays the beast at his second coming if he already did it? And how is it that Christ still has to smite the nations at his second coming in Revelation 19 if he's already done it? He hasn't. And if we're in the kingdom right now and Satan is bound, how is it that Christ slays the beast and the false prophet at his second coming? Considering the fact that it's the beast and the false prophet who deceive, it is through them that the whole world is deceived by Satan into worshiping him. But he's only thrown into the lake of fire when Christ comes. I mean, it doesn't work. But when you take Daniel and Revelation together, these things become clear. They really do. You work them out, it's complicated. There are things we don't understand. When we go through the book of Revelation, there are hard things, things I'm not even going to pretend that I can explain. But if you look at the outline of how it works, that becomes clear. Although, albeit complicated. Any questions? Dean.
In chapter 20 of Revelation, it says that Satan's bound. Now, what's the difference between Satan being bound and the doom of the beast and the false prophet? They were thrown into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone before Satan was bound.
Correct. But remember, they're people. I mean, they're individuals. They're not identical with Satan. And whatever. Well, all that we know is this, that in the Bible says that when Christ returns, Satan will be bound. What that means, it means he'll be limited. He won't be able, whatever it means, however God binds Satan, it means that he will not be able to influence the nations anymore. I mean, that's the point. I mean, binding obviously is metaphorical, but the point is he's not going to deceive the nations anymore. It says that. Now, how's that possible if he only destroyed the beast and the false prophet at his second coming? I mean, in the all-millennial's position, Satan's bound now. But how's that possible? I mean, it doesn't work. But any other questions? Okay, we will next week look at Daniel chapter 9, which I think is the most fascinating prophecy in the Bible. And we will look at the 70 weeks of Daniel. From the 70 weeks comes the 7-week tribulation, or 7-year tribulation. If you want to know why we talk about a 7-year tribulation, the answer is Daniel 9. Daniel 9, nobody doubts it, nobody contends with it. Daniel 9 is one of the most important passages to understanding the dispensational understanding of eschatology. And how we look at it is very important. And it's a wonderful passage because it also predicts to the day when Christ would come to Jerusalem on a donkey. So let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we acknowledge that your word is very deep. We acknowledge there's much we don't understand. And we acknowledge that what we do understand, we only understand because of the Holy Spirit's giving us the ability to understand it. But Father, we want to learn. We want to know these things. We want to understand your truth. We want to search the Scriptures. And Lord, my true prayer is that you would bless us with a genuine love for your kingdom, for your plan, and most of all, Lord, that we would set our eyes, that we would set our hopes on things above, that we would truly be looking for the return of Christ, that we would rejoice at the thought of your return, that we would live today in light of your return. Lord, that we would remember that all these things are written for a purpose. May we search them out. May we delight in them. And may they be our strength from day to day. May we truly delight in your truth. May we go forth from here, and may we be a light wherever we are. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.